You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand. And even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Another Britflix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is Michael Myers of London Horror Society. Welcome to the show.
If only my name was Michael Myers, really. If only. It would be such a much better introduction, wouldn't it?
Yes. Yes, it would. And it flummoxed me. Dear listener, I'm speaking to Chris Niles, and his email tells me when it arrives it's from Michael Myers, which, when you first receive that mail, it's kind of funny and scary at the same time. Do you think, what's happening? It's the London Horror Society.
Yeah. Do you know, it's been quite a, it was one of those things that I did. It sounded like a really good idea to do at the time and since has tripped me up, but I still kind of stand by it. It's almost a good way of filtering out people sometimes. You know, if they reply back with "Dear Mr. Myers" and a funny comment, it always puts a little bit of a spring in my step for the day.
We're here to talk about your five indie filmmaking tips, which we'll get onto in due course. But first and foremost, Chris, do you want to tell the listener about what or who the London Horror Society is?
Yeah. So first of all, thanks very much for having me on the show. I'm really excited to be doing this. The London Horror Society has been in my life for, well, I always think it's about 5 years, but it's not. It's about eight now, which is terrifying in its own way. But it started as a way for me to find like-minded people to watch scary movies with, because all my friends and closest people didn't like horror movies and I did. And, you know, being a complete wuss, I didn't like watching them on my own. So I wanted to really find people that would, you know, be able to share that with me. And I couldn't find some. I mean, this was, like I said, 8-9 years ago, and you know, this was before sort of Facebook and things like that had really taken off as places to really sort of find people that might share interests. So I thought I'd start my own, and so the London Horror Society was born. And it kind of started off, like I said, as a way of finding people to watch films with, but it very quickly kind of opened up, you know, doors into finding, rather than just people that like watching horror movies, it kind of turned me into people that actually kind of liked making them as well. And all of a sudden, this door was open into this brand new community of people that I'd never met before. And, you know, these are a significantly, you know, talented people that, you know, made films. And as a kind of a young sort of naive person that didn't really have a clue about filmmaking, you know, I always thought that making films was for people with either a ton of money or, you know, someone willing to give them a ton of money. And there were these new people that I've met that were, you know, passionate filmmakers and, you know, willing to kind of and able to make really cool pieces on zero budget and by, you know, kind of spit and sawdust, just kind of almost riding on pure passion to get these films made. And, you know, as I mentioned, these were all sort of really great people. And I just kind of felt that, you know, I kind of was very sort of quickly swept up in this world, really loved, you know, meeting people, meeting all these people. They were all such lovely people. I just kind of wanted to get involved, I think, in any way I could. And, you know, I knew writing wasn't my forte. I knew that, you know, directing sounded like, and still I still believe is, incredibly hard work. And for, you know, some insanely talented people to do. So I thought, what could I kind of add to the mix? Well, maybe I can kind of help people shout about their films. You know, maybe I can help kind of, you know, build audiences, or, you know, kind of let people know that these films are around. And so I kind of sort of almost kind of gave a sort of an arm of the society to that. And, you know, by sort of shouting about and, you know, helping build interest in people's films, you know, it really kind of helped me feel part of that community. And, you know, I just wanted, I guess, the bottom line was to help these ridiculously talented people that didn't have that mouthpiece to kind of just kind of yell from the rooftops about, you know, this amazing work that was just going completely under the radar because they didn't have, you know, umpteen million pounds of budget to spend on marketing. And that's sort of where it started, really.
So just very quickly then. So it started off as you trying to find buddies to watch horror films with.
Yep.
And then became a sort of voice piece for independent horror filmmakers at the same time.
Yeah. That's exactly it. I mean, wanting to find people to watch films with turned into, oh my goodness, there's this whole group of people that make incredible pieces. I can't believe this exists. I must shout about this from the rooftops. Essentially was what it was, because, you know, I very kind of quickly came to realize that, you know, and this is no secret, that the more money you have to market anything, you know, films included, will get you bigger audiences. And it just didn't seem right to me that, you know, really significant pieces, really significant, great, you know, films weren't being seen by people because people just didn't know about it or about them, I guess. And it's just, yeah, it just seemed sad.
So for those that don't know the London Horror Society, and that's the first time they've heard of you, is in your introduction there, what activities take place then throughout the year? What is London Horror Society doing to engage with horror audiences to help filmmakers get films made?
Yeah, so, well, pre-pandemic, we used to hold sort of screening evenings where people could come and show their films to audiences. We sort of since have tried to move those online as well. We're working on, we had a sort of a best of event from which we showed some of our sort of favorite short films from over the past few years, a couple of months back, and we're going to be working on our next event for that as well, which we've watched this space, submissions will be open for that soon. Mm-hmm. But I think our most popular one, our most popular event at the moment that we do regularly is what we call our Film Network Speed Pitching.
Okay.
Which is essentially an online event again, which takes place just on Zoom, where we essentially invite anyone who is working on anything creative within the horror genre, or anyone that wants to try and contribute to anything creative in the horror genre. And we give them basically 90 seconds to either pitch their work or pitch themselves.
Okay.
Just try and match people up. We're just literally about to do our fourth, which will probably be done just before this podcast goes out. We try and do that every couple of months. They've really taken off. They've grown. We had, I think, about sort of 30 people turn up for our first one. Our next one, we probably have about sort of 75 to 80 people all on a Zoom call, which is fantastic. I mean, it's great.
No mean feat, Chris.
I know. So they're very highly marshaled, as I'm sure you can expect, where people are, you know, rigidly set to their 90 seconds to talk about their piece. But it's fantastic. I mean, I love it because it's, you know, it's just great hearing about these creative ideas that these people just kind of, as someone that's never been sort of particularly creative in terms of ideas, it just blows my mind when I hear some of the ideas that come out of people where, you know, it's almost like this kind of, it's almost blasé to some of these people. It's like, I had this great idea where we could do this and we could do that. And there's kind of me sitting there, it's like, well, that's the best idea ever. Why haven't you done this? Why hasn't anyone else done this? And, you know, it's just brilliant. And it's really, again, it's a community thing for me. I mean, I think it's so amazing to sort of see the sort of the UK horror community. I think personally is probably one of the most supportive and best communities of people around, you know, not just in film, in you know, ever. And it's just so uplifting, you know, particularly everyone's had such a crap year or crap 18 months, not just, you know, COVID related, you know, politically. It's that society, and I can't believe I'm getting pious about society after 10 minutes of being on this podcast. But I mean, you know, there's so many divisions amongst people now, and there's something really kind of cathartic about seeing just a group of people that love the same thing, talk passionately about their projects and lend support. And, you know, there's nothing better, honestly, when you sort of come back a couple of months later and there's still the same people that have been to each one, you know, talking about how they met X, Y, Z, and now they're doing this. You know, we've had one guy on from every pitching session who's almost charted each individual step on his film. You know, he started off in pre-production and then he's got through production. And then on the next one, he's looking for, you know, editors and you know, VFX help. And it's just amazing. And I'm just so kind of humbled
Chris, where can people get hold of London Horror Society so they can be aware of when things are taking place and how can they join in?
They're more than welcome. So our initial membership for everyone is free. So people can join for that. And that obviously gets you kind of priority kind of access to all of our events. And they can find us on londonhorrorsociety.co.uk. That's our main website. That's where you'll be able to find all of our membership options. We have a premium membership option as well, which is called LHS Pro, which is sort of slightly more high end with a few more sort of bells and whistles on it. But all the details are on the site there. So they're more than welcome to go and check out there. And if they have any questions, we're always around. We're always happy to talk horror. Please do get in touch.
Okay. Well, look, as you've had this experience then, you've sort of, we had a chat about what you might talk about on the podcast and using the mm-hmm. five format. We're going to do the London Horror Society's five indie filmmaking tips. Now, I've got my list of five. We're going to go through them one at a time that you've submitted to me, and we're going to talk for 5 minutes. And just for the listener who's not heard this format before, each one of the five gets 5 minutes maximum. So much like Chris's 90-minute limit for pitches, we'll have a 5-minute chat that'll be limited to 5 minutes, and I won't be so strict as to just shut you up when we get to the end, but you will hear the sound of when we reach 5 minutes, which is quite a rude interruption at the best of times. So you'll be aware of it as you're talking, and I'll be aware of it as it happens.
I like it. Okay.
But obviously, finish your thought. I'm not going to be that bothered. It's more that we don't end up talking about one of your tips for 20 minutes and then the other four for five. It's a conversation, not a monologue. So I will chip in and sort of at where needs be. But, you know, the floor is yours once the clock starts. So tip number one is get your screenplay in order. What do you mean by that statement?
Okay. Well, before I get into that, I'm just going to caveat this with a quick kind of statement in terms of, you know, this is, I've kind of thought of these five tips as a kind of an overview of what we've kind of seen from other people and where people have sort of stumbled on their sort of filmmaking journey. And I think, you know, these five tips are not in any way the best way to perhaps make a film. It's certainly not for everyone. And I think everyone's journey is so very different that these might not apply to everyone. But I'm hoping that they'll be able to give away.
I'm glad you caveated that. Yes, I've interviewed over 500 filmmakers. And I don't think I've heard the same story twice about how they've made the film. So
exactly. But yeah, so the first one, time is going. So yes, get your screenplay in order. Now, this sounds pretty obvious, doesn't it? But you'll be surprised, I think, as to sort of how many people kind of have an idea. They kind of write it down, they kind of get it all excited, and you know, they actually sort of then sort of almost rush into production to sort of get things ready or get things locked down. And I think, you know, there's plenty of time after you've written, after you've firmed up your story, to sort of start thinking about, you know, what's going to look like, what locations you're going to go to. But I think there's just some kind of, there's some good practice tips to, you know, just make sure that your story is not only correct from a sort of a narrative perspective, but also if you're working on a feature or you're looking to kind of, or if you're looking to potentially use your screenplay to raise funds, there's a few boxes I think that it must tick that it almost sounds sad when you're talking about things like format and structure, But it's simple things like this that can, you know, essentially, if you kind of do find your screenplay on the desk of someone with some money to potentially give you, they look at it and your, you know, script's not in the right font, it's going to go in the bin. And as sad as that sounds, because of course the font isn't going to affect the story, it could be the best story in the entire universe. But, you know, if something silly like a font kind of lands it in the bin, then that's disappointing. But, you know, this is why I think it's important to kind of tick those little boxes first, just to make sure that you're not kind of putting yourself up against a brick wall, as it were, before you've even got started.
So everybody, so what you're saying is everybody make sure you're using Courier and it's 12 point.
Exactly.
There is plenty of software available, Final Draft being probably the most expensive, but Fade In is cheaper, Writer Duet and various other ones. There are lots out there and they do all the heavy lifting for you in terms of the
they do
in terms of the formatting.
Exactly, yeah. And I think, you know, that it's simple format like that. That's I think, you know, if you are looking to kind of make filmmaking a career, if you are looking to sort of do it seriously, I think, or even just screenwriting, if you just want to be a writer yourself, I think that's some of those sort of initial expenses or kind of commitments to sort of at least acting, sort of, you know, try to sort of be that professional before you are. I think that's some of the simple things you could do, because like you said, that software kind of does the heavy lifting for you. So if you have something like that, you know you're in a good place, and it makes your life easier anyway, actually, you know, by the sort of the quirks and the benefits of the software, you know, helps you as you sort of go along as well.
Now that's formatted up, but you mentioned structure as well. In what sense do you mean get the screenplay in order in terms of structure?
There's always the temptation, I've often seen, and you know, even like I said, I'm not particularly creative, but even when I've had ideas, there's all these kind of temptations to do these wild and wacky, crazy stories. And I think, again, if you're looking to sort of do something for the first time, or if it's, you know, if you're in the early stages of your filmmaking journey, you're, you know, looking to just sort of make something, get something done, you know, I always think, you know, keep it kind of on a level that is, you know, typical for a film, you know, so I always think, you know, your typical three-act structure, you know, so your setup, your conflict and your resolution is when you're starting out, you know, don't try and reinvent the wheel with your first project. You know, I'm not saying that every film, obviously every good film adheres to those structures, but again, why kind of try and hamstring yourself in doing something incredibly complex, on your first go or your second or your third go? You know, there's plenty of time. Once you've made a few films, once you've written a few screenplays, that's maybe the time where you can go and sort of mess with your typical structure. I mean, you know, some of our favorite films, you know, some directors make a living out of busting that structure out of the park, you know, but it's...
But to be honest with you though, most things that are perceived to break rules and stuff, they still adhere to beginning, middle and end. I mean, if there's a linear narrative, it'll be a beginning, middle, end. Experimental isn't narrative, so therefore you're not dealing with the same thing. So if you're Andrew Cotting or something, then you're going to be, you know, balls to everything. But if you're generally going to have a beginning, middle, and end, then there's something to follow. I would also add to your advice that is in terms of getting a screenplay in order, as someone with this experience at the very least, is to get people to read it, or not your mum or your grand.
Ah, see, that was going to be my next point, Stuart. Good segue. Yeah, it's get that feedback. And as you said, I think even more importantly from that is don't get it from your mum. Don't get it from your mates. You need to get it from people that are not afraid to... Oh, no. Well, okay.
Go on, finish that thought.
It's kind of there, isn't it? It's kind of that, yeah. So just make sure you get that feedback from people that don't know you, because you need that constructive feedback. You don't want someone just to say, oh, this is wonderful, darling. Yes, go and make this. You want someone to tell you the problems, because no one gets it right on the first draft.
Indeed. The first draft is never ready. So don't think because you finished the screenplay, you're done. And also you're going to hear things that are going to piss you off and get you upset. Don't be upset, because that person has taken time to read your screenplay. And if they have, then value that and take what's good. You know your story. They don't.
But it's a lot of work. Yeah. It's like you said, that's a really good point. It's a lot of work to give people notes. So, you know, respect the fact that someone's taken the time to give you some notes if they have.
The thing to take as a writer is you're not obliged to do anything with the notes. But pound to a penny, for every set of notes I've ever had that have made me go, grr, I hate the world, about a week later, when I've thought about them, they begin to make sense and they begin to show opportunities to improve your script, because ultimately getting your script in order is having the best script it can possibly be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, and responding to the feedback and seeing what they're not seeing, or it's almost like see the note with certain, the note within the note, becomes an important part of your job as a writer. But that's as you advance as a writer. But anyway, that is get your screenplay in order. There's a lot more we could have said, but that's a good starting point.
Okay.
So the next 5 minutes, your tip number two is budget carefully. Why would we do that, Chris? What's the reason for budgeting?
Well, I mean, and I think this actually should be something that is in mind as you're writing that screenplay. You know, okay. If you're looking to turn that screenplay into something yourself, if you're looking to bring it into production yourself, you need to be thinking about that budget as you go. And I think it's a pretty good reason, really. It's because it's all well and good, you know, writing some sort of epic adventure with millions of characters and, you know, super locations and props and special effects. But, you know, if you can't afford or don't sort of have access to the, you know, vast wads of money it will cost to actually bring that to screen, then, you know, you're not really going to do your story justice. And I think, you know, it's one of my pet hates, I think, and maybe that's a bit unfair, but when you see people that almost are too ambitious with small packets of money, you know, I think it's, if you're going to do something big, you're going to do it well, or you need to do it well. And sometimes, unfortunately, the only way to do that is if you've got the money to do it. So I think it's, as you're writing it, if you know you're not actually going to have a lot of money to make the production, then there's no harm in trying to sort of scale back a little bit. You know, you can write an amazing piece in set in one location with two people, with one person. So again, it's just kind of knowing.
And we can look at, some of the greats of the last sort of few decades and see, you know, Reservoir Dogs is essentially a warehouse for the vast majority of the movie. It's men talking to men in a warehouse. There's nothing that exciting about what facilities and resources are required to do it, and maybe go to the expense of dressing everyone in a black suit and tie. But apart from that, it's a fairly limited idea. Therefore, you can budget for that kind of film. One that probably the London Horror Society crowd who might be tuning into this podcast will be familiar with would be Charlie Brooker's Dead Set, the zombie thing out of Big Brother. And in a special episode he did of, I think it's probably Scream Web or something, where he talks about writing, he talked about getting a note from his producer where the Range Rover was driving down the road and it blew up. And they were like, we're going to have to blow a Range Rover up. He goes, why? He goes, well, because we need the Range Rover to stop, so they've got to go on foot. And the producers have said, well, it can break down then.
Yeah.
And we don't have to blow a Range Rover up.
Yeah, that's saving yourself 50 grand right there, aren't you? I mean, exactly. That's the difference. And I think that's the thing. And this is where a great producer will help you make this task much easier, because they'll know exactly where you can and where you can't save money. And I think if you're doing it on your own, though, again, if this is the first time and you're looking to produce it yourself, I always think the first thing that anyone needs to do is just look at their script and go massive. And essentially say, so what is the absolute maximum that is going to cost me to do this? So I don't know. There's two actors. Okay, so that's going to cost me X, Y, and Z per day rate, perhaps. And it's going to take us 3 days. So I'm going to need to feed them. I'm going to need to do this. Okay, if I need to hire cameras and equipment, how much is the maximum that's going to cost me? And what you'll quickly find out is you'll start panicking and you will end up with a number that is so far beyond what you would actually be able to make this film for, or what you'd ever be able to raise. And that's great, because once you're there, you know that whatever happens, it's never going to cost you more than that figure to make this film. And then the fun begins. And I think this is where, as an indie filmmaker, this is where your metal is made, because now this is where you kind of start drilling down on either A, what you need and what you don't need, B.
You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand, and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
B, who you need in crew and who you don't need. And C, as well, this is where it gets creative. You know, this is where you kind of, you know, the fun starts of how you start figuring out how you can kind of pull off some amazing shots that would cost, I don't know, Johnny Hollywood 5 million quid to pull off, but it's going to cost you 50 quid in a packet of Quavers. You know, and that's the fun thing. And I think, you know, the temptation is that when you're writing something, you might have, you know, an amazing three-man decapitation scene at the end. But, you know, if you don't have a significant amount of money, again, as I said at the top of this one, it's going to look crap. But what you might actually be able to find is that rather than hiring a great prosthetics guy to make this for you, is there something you can do with some clever camera work to do it and save yourself a shed ton of money to sort of do so? And I think that's kind of almost the crux of indie filmmaking in a nutshell, is to just kind of maximize and almost know where you need to spend, know where.
And also, I can imagine, Chris, this is where your network. There goes the dog barking, but I'll finish.
Oh, there we go. Okay, that was reasonable timing.
This, that your network becomes a forum for finding out how to do the cheats for no money. So,
yeah.
Because I can imagine there's a kind of hive mind that has seen all the DVD extras of umpteen horror films and throughout the ages. So when somebody says, I need to do this, but I can't afford that, then people can go, oh, well, I saw on the making of blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
This was how they cheated it. So there's like, you know, I'm guessing there's techniques that then become ways. But obviously being part of the London Horror Society, you've got more than just what you know in your head to draw upon in terms of advice.
Yeah, I like to think so. I mean, I think, again, and it's not just the London Horror Society, you know, as I said, the UK horror community and the indie film community as well are always massively keen to share, you know, any hints and tips on how to kind of make these hugely ambitious scenes, you know, look easy. And there are shortcuts everywhere. It's like I said, it's this hive mind. And, you know, for one of the good things that social media has brought to our lives is, yes, you can share information very quickly and very easily. It's just a case of knowing where to look and, you know, having the balls to give it a go as well, I think sometimes is one of the big things you know, you can kind of put it off. If, you know, if there is something ambitious there, you know, just give it a try, give it a go. If it doesn't work out, you can always try something else. You can always sort of try it another way.
Well, I'm going to say there's no bigger lesson, is there, than finding out what doesn't work as much as there is finding out what does work. And that sounds mean spirited, but I think all filmmakers up to the highest level are forever getting it wrong to get it right.
Yeah, that's not just filmmaking, is it? You know, you learn best when you make mistakes, and that is 100% exactly the same with filmmaking. And I think, you know, it's just the kicker is with filmmaking is that, you know, if you do it while you're on set, that's costing you a ton of money, because if you get it wrong completely, you have to go back. So that's why, like I said, budgeting carefully is very important, because, you know, it will save, if you get the budget right, you know, you'll be able to sort of iron out those problems before you even get to set.
Indeed. So tip number three, then, why should I not be tempted to do everything myself?
Well, you can. I mean, if you're really tempted, you can, but there are, like I said, and I don't know how many times I've said this already, there are a wealth of brilliant people out there who love this genre and love filmmaking as much as you do, and they might very well be willing to come on and help you. And, you know, no matter who you are, you're not going to be good at everything. You know, as sad as it is to say that, that's not being mean. You know, by virtue of being a human being, you are not going to be good at doing everything. So if you're not good at doing everything, it's good to know what you are good at and what you're not good at. Come to terms with it and find someone who can actually help you with that. And I think, you know, one, again, this community is incredibly supportive. I'm not saying go out there and ask people to do it for you for free. I think if you are going to spend money anywhere, your best investment by tenfold will be people, is to bring people in that know what they're doing, who are, you know, more experienced than you in various areas. And don't be afraid to sort of ask for help. I mean, I think you need to be honest with people. I think, you know, don't bring people on if you can't afford to pay them what they either want or what they're worth. But at the, on the flip side of that, people are in this job for love as well as money on very kind of, on a lot of occasions. So, you know, if they have the time and if they have the sort of the means to perhaps do a couple of days or help you out on something, and they like you and they like your script, then they actually might do it, you know. And
I think, Chris, that's the important point. I think people liking each other is a great motivator for helping out and giving you time for free. A big demotivator is when someone is behaving entitled to the help, and then when they get some, they abuse the help. So while obviously this is meant to be advice about not being tempted within yourself, it also means that knowing your limits doesn't mean that everyone else is there just to service your film, that there is a great deal of brinkmanship and negotiation to be had.
100%. And I think, look, for me, whenever I've been lucky enough to work on a film in any capacity, part of the fun and part of the rewarding experience that it is meeting those people that you will then go and make other stuff with. I think when it comes to sort of crewing up a project, I think no matter what kind of other people you have in, you know, knowing that someone is great to work with is probably, you know, the number one differentiator of what's going to set you apart from someone else. And I think, you know, by sort of having a reputation for treating people badly on set, you're going to struggle horrendously. Mm. And, you know, it's respect as well. It's like, you know, treat people as you expect to be treated yourself in any way. It doesn't matter if you're paying them or not. I think that by networking and meeting new people, not only are you going to, you know, expand your own personal network for the films that you make, you know, you might actually kind of be able to sort of meet people to go and, you know, lend a hand on other people's sets. And again, it's that kind of networking kind of vibe, really, that sort of brings people together. You know, the more people you know, the better, because again, you know, you're going to need to bring in people for films that you might not have worked with before. But if, you know, Mr. X can give you a great reference to Mr. Y, then, you know, this is how this will make your life easier, far, far easier in the future. So, you know,
if somebody doesn't reach out, what are the pitfalls of trying to do everything yourself? What have you seen happen?
I think it's just, again, if you're not good at everything, it's going to fall down at some point. I mean, you can't be a good writer, a good director, a good editor, a good sound mixer. You know, it's just impossible to be that person. And yes, you can do it. You genuinely can do it. You can kind of try your hand at it. But I think the filmmaking is a very precise skill, you know, particularly when it comes to the things that you can't sort of scrimp on, you know, so sound, editing, you know, the mix, things like that. If you don't get that right, it will take people out of the film. There's been so many occasions where I've seen a film kind of come to screen, which is visually beautiful, the story is fantastic, but the sound's terrible. And it's, you know, no matter how good everything else might be, I am completely out of this film because the sound's bad. So it's a case of, you know, well, maybe the director or the producer thought that they could do it themselves, so they'd save themselves a few pennies and sort of do it that way, or not kind of put it out and ask someone to sort of help out. And at the end of it, their film kind of is almost meaningless because you're taken out of it by a sort of a bad decision. And again, like I said, it's not an admission of failure by saying, you know, I'm not good at everything. And I think ask the question, see if you can bring someone in. You know, people might say no, but you've got to give it a go, I think. It's knowing your limit.
And it is, and ultimately, from one thing I've learned from all the people I've interviewed is that it's a collaborative medium, filmmaking.
100%. I mean, you'll never find a film made by one person.
Yeah, exactly. And that objective eye on any part of the process by somebody that's not wedded to it because they weren't there when you had the first kernel of the idea could be the difference between it being brilliant and being all right because you got it through the gate in the end. And And by not allowing yourself that opportunity, you could be compromising your own project, which is my long-winded way of going, tip number four is be flexible but thorough. What do you mean by that?
Yes. So things are going to go wrong. As soon as you get to set, or even beforehand, to be honest, things are going to go wrong. Things are going to kind of trip you up on the way. Things are going to happen that you didn't expect to, or maybe you didn't prepare for. But you've got to be able to roll with those punches and be flexible, because just because something might go wrong or something might sort of happen that you weren't particularly expecting, it doesn't have to knock you completely off course. You know, I'm not saying that you should kind of roll up into a set with your screenplay and think, you know, sod it, see what happens, we'll kind of get through this and just, you know, start rolling. That's absolutely not the case. Mm. You know, I think overall, out of anything, I feel the kind of the number one perhaps indie tip is prepare. Just, you know, prepare as much as you can, because that will help. But it's that flexibility, because you will not prepare for everything. But having that flexibility, or being able to sidestep issues and then think, okay, it's raining outside, so we can't shoot that now. But, you know, can we move this around? Can we move this one scene that we could do now today and then sort of try again tomorrow when the weather forecast is a bit better? You know, I think some people get so ingrained in their schedules and their plans and sort of, you know, lock down so much where, you know, if the slightest wrinkle happens, you know, it's panic stations and the shoot kind of fails. And I think having that kind of open-minded flexibility to, you know, pivot into new scenarios should they arise will help you, you know, a lot, to be honest, because, you know, it's all well and good, you know, trying to sort of panic and sort of figure something out. But there's also, it sounds almost a little bit trite, but I think if the producers and the directors are on set kind of panicking, then everyone's kind of, it's going to sort of make almost like a kind of a tense environment. And, you know, having the leaders kind of freaking out because they're not going to be able to get a particular shot in is going to sort of reverberate around the rest of the crew. And just having that kind of foresight to know that things are going to go wrong and to try and not prepare accordingly, because I don't think you can in some aspects, but just know that you will be able to get it in the can. You will be able to kind of sidestep things.
And also, you know, as well, that flexibility, I think, is that you may well be working with people with more experience than you, and for them seeing a kind of pig-headed approach of this is what we set out to do, this is what we'll do, even right. though experience tells other people this is not going to work. Or this is not going to be effective. When, yeah. Like you say, we could wait 24 hours, we could go and do something else.
Yeah, but it's also not just for the negative things as well. I mean, there's actually, you know, to be flexible for things that could actually be more positive than what you actually thought. So one of the things that you see quite a lot is when you have your talent on set, you know, you might have your screenplay that you've crafted, particularly as I say, point one, this is almost kind of contradicting that a little bit, but, you know, your talent might turn around and say, well, that line's really good, but what if I did it, said it like this? And what if I did it like this? And if you were kind of not willing to be flexible, you might think, actually, no, let's kind of go what's in the script. But, you know, one of the great things about a great actor is that, you know, their ideas are fantastic. You know, they've had that experience there. And, you know, also if they think a delivery in this way or in their set way would be better than yours, then it's likely to come out better than what it might have been written in. I mean, you know, I'm not saying that you have to sort of listen and make those decisions based on what the actors say every time, but have that flexibility to be open to ideas, you know, because often it will come out far better for you. And I think, yeah, as you said, you know, you don't want to be that kind of crew. You don't want to be that sort of director that is a complete stickler and sort of closed to any ideas, because, you know, once those cameras are rolling, that's when you really see what your script's all about. That's what you really see what your production's actually coming together and being. So be open to sort of those changes. But one of the big caveat to this is that you need to be flexible, but you cannot be slapdash. You know, you can't use flexibility as an excuse to, you know, cut corners. You know, how many times has this probably been said on your part, you know, your podcast? You can't fix it in post every time. You genuinely can't. It's the worst phrase ever. So don't cut corners in anything, you know, particularly things like, you know, the easy things like insurance and your editing, things like that. Just make sure you get that extra take if you think you need it. You know, don't use it as an excuse to claw back some minutes on your schedule. You know, just make sure you get that extra take, you know, make sure you back up that hard drive, you know, make sure, you know, make sure you just get everything out of that shoot that you absolutely need, because you're not going back. So get it all done very, very quickly. Oh, look at that.
Look at that. You've morphed into five minute takes on things.
My mental clock is on it.
Well, look, the final tip number five, is plan your release strategy early. I presume the emphasis is on the early, not the plan bit. So why do we plan it early?
Well, I think, again, with everyone's sort of release strategy, it's going to encompass a few particular things. You're either going to be looking for distribution, and, you know, if you're not, you're probably going to be looking at festivals as well, or either or. And with those things comes costs and extra planning. And I think, again, as I said in the last point, I think overall, the more planning and prep you can do, the better. And I think if you do it early, you're going to sort of iron out some of the sort of the big surprises, I think. And, you know, it's hard to think about the strategy, your release strategy, I think, when you're in the pre-production stage, because, you know, and rightly so, all your effort is in how the bloody hell do I get this thing in the can with so little money. You know, so I certainly don't blame people for not necessarily thinking about the release.
And I think let's be honest here, we're talking more, if someone's trying to make a feature film, I think if someone's making a short film, yeah, there's certainly places that will show it. You know, shorts.tv, for example, certainly do acquire short films, but it's not what you would call a release. So, and I think that if you're making a feature film, it's to your benefit that you think about where this is going to get seen. You know, you can make, you don't have to be making something that's going to win the Palme d'Or. You can still be making, you know, Cannibals and Buckets of Blood if you want, but know full well where that goes. And one thing I've learned of late on the podcast from speaking to producers is that a mistake a lot of indie filmmakers make is that they really please themselves, get it in a festival, and then you've given up your world premiere to no effect. So while you can go and see it and it's exciting and it be like sort of a B or a C grade festival,
absolutely,
if your film was ever to attract the attention of a sales agent and a distributor, they'd want to help plan your release. So almost in a way, your strategy should be, I need to get a distributor and or sales agent on board to help me release the film, because I'm not a exhibitor who can control that element of it.
Mm. No, you're absolutely right. And I think, again, you need to do this early. I mean, we were speaking at LHS Pro. We were talking to a film sales and acquisitions manager about when they sort of typically want to look for scripts. And he said that, you know, more often than not, they want to see scripts early before they've actually gone into production. Because, you know, if someone's interested in coming on board as a film sales agent, they can help iron out issues in your script, you know, before you've even got there.
You as a filmmaker will also understand what the market thinks of your idea. If you expose it to people like sales agents or distributors when it's at script stage, that doesn't mean you have to change anything, but it does mean you understand where you're going. So when they say, that's a bit too, because, you know, there are horror sales distribution companies and there are horror and sales distribution companies. Some of them just want you to throw the claret around and rip off limbs. Mm-hmm. Others want you to come up with the next Babadook. And obviously they're all horror films.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're not the same, are they?
No, that's right. And I think that's, if you're making a feature film and you want to put it out for distribution or try and get it distributed, you have to, unfortunately, remember that, you know, this is a commercial activity. You know, people are only going to want to pick it up if they feel that it can make money. And, you know, if you are looking to make a career out of this and sell your film, then, you know, you have to take that on the chin, you know, and sometimes sort of jump through the hoops that comes with. And there's absolutely obviously no shame in that. You know, everyone has to make a living somehow. But I think also, even if it's not something you're looking for, if distribution isn't what you're looking for, you know, if you are, like you said, making a short film, you know, you still need to look at your market, your audience early to know where to position it. Because I think even having that, like you said, even in horror, there's a, you know, multitude of subgenres that you can go after. And knowing when you're sort of building up the sort of the buzz for your film, you know, there's these particular subgenres, they kind of congregate in their own little niches, which is great. It's a case of, you know, if you can find those people and speak to those people early, you can build up a better buzz for your film rather than saying, oh, I'm making a horror film, I'm just going to, you know, go on to Facebook and speak to all the horror film groups. You know, take your time. You know, figure out who your audience actually is going to be and start talking to those people. I mean, I'm not saying at maybe a screenplay stage where, you know, you're looking for, you know, screenplay tips.
Go on, finish your thought.
Well, by the dog. But yeah, I mean, it's know your audience. And then from there, as you said, when it comes to festivals, when it comes to sort of submitting to the right festivals, you know, do your research. You know the festival that is going to be right for you. You know, it might not be, you know, everyone dreams of playing Cannes or South by Southwest or, you know, TIFF or somewhere like that. But, you know, your key festival might be one of the more regional ones, you know, where you can go and actually network properly with people that, you know, love horror or love whatever particular genre you're going for. So again, it's pre-planning, because you'll save a lot of money on submission fees as well. You know, if you don't know what festivals you need to submit to and you start, you know, willy-nilly throwing out applications everywhere, you're going to spend an absolute packet. And the amount of people that don't account for that when they're in their budgeting phase and end up spending double their budget just on festival submissions is pretty common. So I think, yeah, just a little bit of extra planning and a bit of research
will go a very long way. I can speak with the experience of someone that got burnt quite a lot by the amount of submission fees I hadn't allowed for. It soon mounts up. 10 festivals soon mounts up to a sizable chunk of change when you've made your no budget short film.
Exactly. And I think that's where that kind of being selective needs to happen. And, you know, that's before you even actually go and attend these things as well and actually go and meet people. You know, again, that costs money. So again, it's just a way of, you know, maximizing your buck, essentially.
Indeed. Well, look, let's remind people then of your top tips. So tip one was get your screenplay in order. Tip two was budget carefully. Tip three was don't be tempted to do everything yourself. Tip four is the other side of that coin, which is be flexible but thorough. And tip five, plan your release strategy early.
There you go.
Thank you for those indie filmmaking tips. Let's remind people, how can they find more about London Horror Society and get involved themselves?
So please come to our website. It's www.londonhorrorsociety.co.uk. Mm-hmm. Like I said, our initial membership is absolutely free, and we'd love to have you. And you'll also find us on Twitter and Instagram, usual social media haunts. A handle for each is at London Horror Soc, SOC. Please do come and find us. We'd love to have you on board. And thank you very much.
Well, thank you for giving us your time on the BritFlix podcast.
No problem at all.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.